totem della città, largo. La 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 la. Resto bottega che la mai già, resto. La 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 la.
Thomas Hampson has been a major presence on the operatic stage for over 30 years. He's also considered one of the finest concert artists and recitalists of his generation. And he shows absolutely no signs of slowing down. This month, as he makes his company role debut as Macbeth at the Metropolitan Opera, he will be honored by the Met Guild as a master singer. He can also be heard in recital, both live in Ridgewood, New Jersey, and in broadcasts of Song of America on Sunday nights right here on WQXR. And American baritone Thomas Hampson is my guest today here on WQXR. Welcome, Thomas.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Well, you're being honored by the Met Opera Guild this month as a Met master singer, and it begs the question, at this time in your career when many singers start thinking about winding things down, you appear to have as much fire and enthusiasm as ever, maybe even more, right?
When they called me and told me that the Met Opera Guild had bequeathed me this honor this season, you could have pushed me over with a feather. I'm deeply grateful and moved. And of course, being the cynical perennial singer, immediately said, "What, am I retiring? Is this my gold watch? Am
exactly.
I done?
You're right.
Is this it?"
Right.
And fortunately, the answer came back, "No, Tom, it's 25 years, and thank you very much, and, you know, enjoy this." And I am enjoying it, and it is, you know, we singers don't look back so easily. We can tell you what we're going to do in 5 years or 3 years and what lunch needs to be in 2.5 years, but actually going through this process with the master singers and presentation, the film, and going through all these photos and all these things, especially New York-centric that I've been part of, you kind of forget. You forget how long, what spans of time, and you know, it's been a wonderful 20-25 years, and yes, I've been doing this for a while, and no, I couldn't imagine doing anything else, and I feel stronger and in a lot of ways more able than ever. Certainly some things you do differently than you did 20 years ago, for goodness sakes, but there's also other things that are possible, and your thought process has become, I think, more clear, and your use of your physical energy has become more precise, and fortunately, my voice is very much intact. That's also not an accident. I've been a real voice technician and a disciplined singer and for some years, and believe in that discipline very devotedly. I'm also a great student of singing. I adore my forefathers and foremothers and have listened to them in so many different contexts.
Any ones in particular?
Well, you know, practically any of them that did it. Certainly I know the baritone world very well, whether that's going all the way back to Battistini at the turn of the century. You know, certainly Giuseppe De Luca has been an idol of mine from singers of years gone by. You know, and I love the fact that Robert Merrill and Leonard Warren, icons of the New York operatic scene, both worshipped at the feet of Giuseppe De Luca here in New York. So there's a connectivity in the singer community.
Decidi il mio destino, e tu rimani, tu sai la festa fin, e parte ognun che tu fai.
Robert Merrill as Silvio and Victoria de los Angeles as Neda in Act One of Leoncavallo's Pagliacci. Robert Merrill, one of several baritones who inspired Thomas Hampson in the early days of his career. I'm Midge Woolsey, and my guest today is Thomas Hampson, who is being honored this month by the Met Opera Guild as a Met Master Singer. So in putting together the Master Singer program, which sounded like it might have been just a little bit of fun for you, do you remember what got you interested in singing in the first place?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. You know, I was raised in a very musical environment. My mother's very musical and performed in light opera, but also as the church organist. We children, I have two older sisters, we were very much encouraged to be musical and take piano lessons and play instruments. And, you know, I started with piano and started with trumpet, and for a while was fascinated with the tuba, and actually was quite good at it. I even played a solo with the orchestra, of course called Asleep in the Deep. And then I went away to boarding academy for high school, and their band and choir were at the same time. I had always sung in choir, and I found it slightly more fun, and bearing no ill will to my colleagues, the girls were a lot cuter in the chorus than they were in the band. And it just seemed like a lot less work, you know, schlepping a tuba around is, you know. Anyway, I joined the choir, and I took my first voice lessons with a man who still teaches voice in San Francisco, Lynn Wickham. And, you know, I was encouraged that I had a pleasant sound, and, you know, there I started going down that road. And it was probably after high school, going from high school to college, and I met my most profound voice teacher, Sister Marietta Coyle, who was a Catholic nun, which was a pretty wonderful experience for a boy raised Seventh-day Adventist. So there was that dialogue. But she had studied with Lotte Lehmann and Charles Panserat and was down with Bill Vernard in the academic blooming of the scientific studies of vocalism in the 50s in USC. So this was, you know, very, very powerful confrontation for me in Spokane. And she really, you know, she handed me books of Schubert and books of Fauré and records of Gérard Souzé and certainly Fischer-Dieskau and Pry and said, you know, go home, have a listen to this. Maybe something will, you know, maybe there's a spark in there someplace. And of course, my life was changed. It completely changed.
Par l'âme de l'oiseau.
Les Berceaux, a beautiful lullaby by Gabriel Fauré. That was the voice of the great French baritone Gérard Souzet with pianist Dalton Baldwin. Now, I understand that you did spend a lot of time working with Leonard Bernstein during your career, and you certainly have the looks for the musical theater stage, the Broadway stage. How is it that you didn't end up going in that direction?
Well, by the time I met Lenny the month of my Met debut as the Count in 1986 at the Met. And Lenny was putting together an American cast. He wanted to take an American cast to Rome to the Santa Cecilia Orchestra for a production and recording with Deutsche Grammophon of La Boheme. And, of course, you know, everybody wanted to be part of that project. I didn't know anything about it until it was almost decided behind the scenes, you know, this is the kid that Lenny should get to know. So I went over for an audition to Lenny's house, apartment, and took a Mozart aria and took Avant de quitter ces lieux, something that was operatic, as it were, and I took Zu Strasbourg auf der Schanze of Gustav Mahler. Well, so, you know, we're warming up there, waiting for Lenny to come in, and he's actually listening around the corner, doing whatever he's doing, and he comes in. I said, well, what do you want to hear? I've got some Mozart. And he said, well, if you couldn't sing Mozart, you wouldn't beat the Mets. We don't need to hear that. What else you got? And I said, well, Avant de quitter ces lieux. And he said, yeah, but, you know, you got the high notes. I got the, what else you got? And I said, well, I did bring this Mahler song. Mahler song? You sing Mahler songs? And I said, well, yeah. Which one? So I told him, he said, oh, let's have a listen to that. So he lights up a cigarette and sits down. And I started
setting the stage for a wonderful performance.
Exactly. So I started with Zu Strasbourg auf der Schanze, and about a third of the way in, as you get into the rather more lyric part of the song, and especially the very high lyric voix mix of the song and so forth, he looked at me and he stopped smoking, and his cigarette was just in his fingers, and he was just looking at that. And I got done with that phrase, and he said, "Do that again." And he looked at me and said, "Why do you sing it like that?" I said, "Why do I sing it like what?" He said, "Why do you sing that phrase like that?" And I said, "Well, maestro, that's what Mahler wrote. That he wrote sotto voce, and he wrote it those." I said, "You mean I should maybe sing the lower pitches?" He said, No. "Why do you sing it like that?" I said, "Because that's what he wrote, and that's the sentiment of this kid." And so I went off about, you know, all this, you know, the horror thing, as if Lenny didn't know what the poem was about. He got this huge smile on his face. He said, "All right, let's go back. Let's start at the beginning." What was supposed to be a 15-minute audition turned into an hour-and-a-half voice lesson.
Unbelievable.
And from that day forward until the day he died, which unfortunately was 4 years later, and many roads together between there, I was, you know, part of his young musicians, wing over them, give them a start, believe in them. What am I going to say? Mentoring. It wasn't like Lenny sat you down and taught you. I suppose if you were a conducting student, certainly he did, or a pianist. But for singers, it was more a process of enlightenment. It was more of a process of saying, here's why you sing, and here's the musical phrase, and let go, let's do that. And, of course, he adored singers. So if mm-hmm. he found a singer he identified with, after a concert he would say, you know, "We sounded great tonight," or "Oh, that was, you know, a terrific sing. Oh, I've never sung so well," you know, that kind of thing.
Interesting.
It was a very beautiful friendship and a very beautiful memory. Selber darf ich nicht getrauen, ihre Macht zuzuschauen. Blicke mir nicht in die Lieder, deine Neugier ist verrat. Ihnen fällt sie Zellen bauen, lassen auch nicht zu sie schauen, schauen selbst auch nicht zu. Wenn die reichen Honig haben, sie total gefördert haben, dann vor allem lasche du, dann vor allem lasche du.
baritone Thomas Hampson singing Do Not Look at My Songs, music by Gustav Mahler, the text by Friedrich Rückert. Leonard Bernstein conducted the Vienna Philharmonic. One of the things that I have heard, and you can probably clarify this for me, is that when Leonard Bernstein worked with a singer, he seemed to bring out the best in the singers. But some singers have intimated that he was a little tough on singers. What is your take on it?
You know, that's a wonderful question because it goes to the heart of what we do. Detailed sensitivity. If you're not ready to work hard and confront every part of your personality and every part of what you can be as a human being, to let that be at the disposal of what artistry you want to hope is inside of you, not for you, but for what you are going to make audible and realizable to the world. If you're not ready for that, or if you're not prepared for that, then you won't have a fulfilled life in this occupation or as an artist. And if anything got in the way of that around Lenny, himself first and foremost in every facet, but if he didn't feel you were challenging yourself or something else was in your way, he could get very frustrated. I never was around anything that was ugly. I never saw demands from him that I thought were unreasonable. Did I sweat and work hard and was I scared spitless sometimes? Yeah, sure. But that's what you do.
Rauschen, du fändest Ruhe dort. manche Stunde entfernt von jenem Ort. Und immer hör ich's rauschen, du fernes
Maestro Wolfgang Sawallisch was the pianist, and my guest today, Thomas Hampson, was the baritone soloist in Der Lindenbaum, The Linden Tree. Away I walked for hours, whence stands the linden tree, and still I hear it whispering, you'll find your peace with me. I'm Midge Woolsey, and this is 105.9 FM, WQXR. You grew up and trained here in the U.S., as you mentioned, and yet when I first met you, which I think was in the late 80s, you were living, I believe, in Vienna, and I'm just wondering how you came to live there and whether or not the transition to living in Europe as opposed to living in America was a tricky one for you.
You know, I really appreciate that question, especially even now as I'm more well-known and all that, because some people might be confused about that. My career really started on both sides of the Atlantic very early. I went from California in the late 70s, early 80s. I had won the Met auditions. I was not accepted into any of the young artist programs. I had won quite a bit of competition money in Los Angeles, which was is a very lucrative competition circuit, and I had met a German theater agent, Wolfgang Stoll, in a competition where I'd won second. And he said, look, if you've got money and you want to come over and try and get a job, I know I can get you some work. And at that point, I was still, I don't want to say ambivalent, but I was completely undecided about this whole career thing. I had no confidence or reason to be confident that I had that kind of talent. The day before I left to move to Dusseldorf in August of 1981, Richard Gaddis called me from St. Louis. He was running St. Louis, and he said, and he had known me as he was a judge for a couple of rounds of competitions, but especially the Met auditions, and he said, I'm putting together a young American team, the best of what we think is the new American generation for Così Fan Tutte next summer. You know, I'd like you to do this. And so by the time I arrived in Dusseldorf, one of the first conversations I had with him was, by the way, next June, I'm not here. I'm in St. Louis.
This guy is hot.
Exactly. So it literally, you know, like going up two different ladders at the same time, I was an American living in Dusseldorf and starting my career, and I came back, and from St. Louis came Santa Fe, and from Santa Fe came Aix-en-Provence, and, you know, you start working up the ladder. And it was several years later, it was not until 85 that I sang for Jimmy in Salzburg,
Levine. James Levine.
And he went off in the moon, and I'm sure it was because of my professional experience as well, not only just my voice, but it was, and I was to make my debut at the Met in 88 with Carlos Kleiber. But Ponell and Renato Brusson had a tremendous falling out, and Brusson canceled the Nozze di Figaro, the revival. And Levine and Ponell, like a, you know, couple of great uncles, sat around one day and said, well, let's give the kid a chance. What do you think? And I had been doing Così Fan Tutte, a new production, with Hanoncourt and Ponell in Zurich. So, you know, these things, the wind gets your sails. You're in the right place at the right time. You're prepared. You're eager. You like to work, things start happening.
Anch'io di tutto. peccati.
Ci sarete, sì, signor, ci sarete, sì, signor, ci sarete, sì, signor.
Thomas Hampson, Hans-Peter Blockwitz, and Ferruccio Furlanetto making their first entrance in Mozart's Così fan tutte. James Levine led the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. Let's go on to the Met and this production of Macbeth, which is your company role debut. You have played the role before, correct?
Yeah, a lot. I'm always amused by that word, debut.
Well, I mean, it makes it exciting for all of us who are here in New York. Just curious to know whether or not you're finding anything new in the character this time around.
Oh, you know, Midge, when you sing the great masters, but let's just look at Verdi. This is one of the great pleasures of the operatic world versus the theatrical world. They tend to do a production and move on. Very seldom do they actually repeat roles, and certainly certainly film actors. And we ripen. But I don't think anybody feels that that's where they really found themselves.
Part of the fun, I think, having had the pleasure of actually doing some Shakespeare myself on stage, part of the fun is reciting the words on stage. Mm. So let's talk about stage versus opera. Do you think anything gets, quote unquote, lost in the translation from stage to opera?
I don't think lost in translation is how I would put it. I think that we have to be very careful to make sure that when we talk about plays that are set to music, or in fact plays that become operas, are in fact not plays set to music. This is not Shakespeare's Macbeth in a musical context.
Mm-hmm.
This is Verdi's construction of the Macbeth dilemma,
right,
as an opera. Yes, there are some phrases that have been directly translated into Italian, but that's not the thrust of it. The people sitting at the Metropolitan reading the translation of their boards are not going to be reading Shakespeare quotes all night long. There are some direct quotes, as I said, but I think that's a very important point, that the opera is not the theatrical musical version of it. And I would go one point further. I feel very strongly about always reminding people that opera is a musical art form with a theatrical context. Every breath I take in an operatic performance is essentially part of the overriding panorama of Giuseppe Verdi. You, as an actress doing Shakespeare, are left a great deal more flexibility, if that's the right word, interpretive, if that's the other right word, and, of course, relationship to a stage director. This is one of the first things that a stage director deeply steeped in theatrical tradition must confront in the operatic tradition. The operatic tradition, I would maintain, is a more decoding process than the theatrical process. This is where the idea of lost in translation, I think, is very important. What we have that is not lost in translation is the language of music.
Thank you.
Baritone Leonard Warren, deep in thought at the beginning of the final scene of Verdi's Macbeth, singing "Curses Alone Will Be Your Epitaph." Eric Leinsdorf conducted the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. I'm Midge Woolsey, and today on WQXR, my guest is baritone Thomas Hampson. How do you feel, as a general rule, how do you feel at the end of the performance? Just you, Thomas Hampson.
Well, it certainly depends on the character, but I think any opera that you inhabit, or maybe better put, inhabits you for that intense 3 to 4 hour period. Also, the physicality of singing is something that also sometimes goes perhaps underestimated. It is a very athletic endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
But especially if you are trying to recreate a character of complex dimensions, whether that be more complex negative or more complex positive, that complex reliving is very exhausting. And there's a kind of euphoria, a high, when you're done or you're in it, that thing we now call the zone, as it were, and that's all very important. I think you have to be very careful of the paths that you travel, that you know the road home, both physically and psychologically. You know, characters that I play that are very, very dark. I've always had a real problem with Don Giovanni. Don Giovanni is, for me, probably the most exhausting role emotionally and psychologically that I played. But Giovanni, partly as it's the music of Mozart, leaves the flesh and blood of this man very much on your skin. And I've always thought that the real fundamental, intriguing power of Giovanni is the fact that he's a psychopath and a sociopath. Whatever is humorous in the piece is a kind of black humor that relieves the very real edge of something that is truly diabolical. And this diabolicalness of Don Giovanni is something that can inhabit any one of us at any point in our lives. And it is probably what some people would call the unpardonable sin. It is the abject, unwilling arrogance to believe in anything greater than yourself. To the extent that murder becomes a part of your own plot rather than a destruction of life. And this is a very difficult evening if you really want to, you know, go there, as it were. You know, Giovanni is... And the last scene, you know, is just, it's not every day that you stand there and raise your fist at God and say, "You're sitting in my seat."
Di cibo mortale.
Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau as Don Giovanni, with Walter Kreipel and Carl Christian Kohn and the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra, as the arrogant nobleman is dragged into the underworld in the final scene from Mozart's Don Giovanni. I'm Midge Woolsey. I'm speaking with baritone Thomas Hampson today on WQXR. Thomas, before I let you go, I want to talk about your radio series, Song of America. We are enjoying hearing it on Sunday nights at 9 o'clock here on WQXR. And I understand that there are those who now call you the ambassador of American song. So I'm wondering why you chose American. Why American song?
Oh, what a wonderful question. First and foremost, I think what people generally can identify with is that very often, if you know anything about classical music and classical song, you can, especially if you like, you know, Schubert and Schumann, we sit around going, well, who's our Schumann, Schubert, and who's our Brahms over here in America, we ask ourselves. And that question plagued me for some time, too. And it's a question that is easily done away with if we simply look at composers and poets in the way that they've tried to tell the story of being in America or of America, and let that identify their creative processes rather than putting them on some sort of ridiculous comparison list with other phenomenally creative people of another kind of culture. How we create in this country is different, but it should be different than other creators in other cultures. Now, what becomes quite interesting in our culture, you know, we are Germans and French and Dutch and Italians and Slavs and so forth and so on. And that influence has been very profound, especially in different regions of our country, in how that story of being America has been told. And this is endlessly fascinating to me. But I'll tell you a story. When I was really starting to bear down on this for my own personal study, I came across a wonderful book about Stephen Foster, written by a man, a wonderful professor, now deceased, William Austin. And he spends the first 2.5 chapters talking about folk song in Europe, the whole phenomenon of the Ossian narrative of folk literature, which is, you know, Macpherson and so forth. It's the birth, really, of Schubert. The phenomenon of Thomas More, which is really what Stephen Foster wanted to be in America. He wanted to be the American version of Thomas More. Of course, Robert Burns shows up. And then all of a sudden, here comes this whole huge chapter on Des Knaben Wunderhorn, the youth's magic horn. This preoccupation in all of Western cultures in the beginning of the 19th century to identify folk song. And the big point what becomes very exciting about this is that we tend to think of a folk song as, you know, the Ur, meaning the original, that there's some sort of Ur cave under the Ur tree where this Ur individual with the Ur beard utters some sort of Ur utterance called folk. And this is, you know, this is what we really think. And it's kind of bizarre. But in fact, the man who started this whole phenomenon, the mentor of Goethe, which was Herder, was not looking for that. He was looking for the stuff that rose like the cream on the milk up to the top, the stuff that stayed in the folk vernacular. Mm-hmm. That's why Lindenbaum of Schubert is properly identified as both a classic song and a folk song, both in melody and in poem. But this is a little bit different way to look at it. And I took a chapter out of that and I thought, no, wait a minute. What about the stuff that stayed in our social vernacular? Mm-hmm. Or what about the stuff, more importantly, that we've not allowed to stay? In other words, we keep reinventing our experiment here called America. And quite frankly, a lot of the stories about any individual epoch with its own dilemmas and trials and obscenities are in our poetry.
The dew bend on earth's tip.
one of the 8 poems by Emily Dickinson, set to music by Aaron Copland. That was soprano Dawn Upshaw with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Hugh Wolfe. And The World Feels Dusty, a selection from an album that Dawn Upshaw made in 1994 with my guest today, Thomas Hampson. Now, I understand you've actually spent some time working pretty closely with one of our other great champions of song in general, Marilyn Horne.
Marilyn Horne is the mentor of any American singer in her generation or generations to follow. She's one of the greatest American artists that we can profess to have birthed, and her example of discipline, ability, sheer wonder at her talent is just one of the great blessings of our culture.
I want me a cat. My cat please me. I fed my cat under yonder tree. My cat says fiddle I fee. I bought me a duck, my duck please me. I fed my duck under yonder tree. My duck says quack, quack. My cat says fiddle I fee. I bought me a goose, my goose please me. I fed my goose under yonder tree. My goose says quack, quack. My duck says quack, quack. My cat says fiddle I fee. I bought me a hen, my hen please me. I fed my hen under yonder tree. My hen says shimmy shack, shimmy shack. My goose says quack, quack. My duck says quack, quack. My cat says fiddle I fee. I bought me a pig, my pig please me. I fed my pig under yonder tree. My pig says grieving, grieving. My hen says shimmy shack, shimmy shack. My goose says quack, quack. My duck says quack, quack. My cat says fiddle I fee. I bought me a cow, my cow please me. I fed my cow under yonder tree. My cow says baa, baa. My pig says greeting, greeting. My hen says jimmy shack, jimmy shack. My goose says quack, quack. My duck says quack, quack. My cat says fiddle I fee. I bought me a horse, my horse please me. I fed my horse under yonder tree. My horse says my cow says wah, wah. My pig says greeting, greeting. My hen says shimmy shack, shimmy shack. My goose says quack, quack. My duck says quack, quack. My cat says fiddle I fee. I bought me a wife, my wife please me. I fed my wife on the yonder tree. My wife says honey, honey. My horse says neigh, neigh. My cow says baa, baa. My pig says greeting, greeting. My hen says shimmy shack.
Marilyn Horne with the English Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Carl Davis, and one of Aaron Copland's old American songs. American composer Paul Bowles is on the program when you perform in Ridgewood, New Jersey, as part of the Parlance Chamber Series. And I'm just wondering, because you are going to switch gears from the opera world to the recital stage in the course of 1 week. What is the key to making that happen?
Somebody asked me the other day, I mean, the word in my life that is probably the most predominant word, period, is balance. I think the analogy I can offer that is the easiest metaphor, if you will, is a tennis player. You know, there's the game of tennis. But if you're going to play asphalt or grass or clay, you've got a different set of contexts that you need to take care of. Is it still the same swing? Is the technique still the base? Yes and yes and yes. So first and foremost, I think it's being clear that what I do on the stage as Macbeth has in one very significant way absolutely nothing to do with Paul Bowles. And even on that program is Chanson Madagascar of Ravel. That's also a different world. So I think what I would encourage young colleagues and even my general public to embrace is that specific moment of now, which is Ravel's moment or Paul Bowles' moment, which is Paul Bowles and Tennessee Williams, one of the most wonderful 8 minutes of American culture I could possibly offer anybody.
Kind of fabulous.
Oh, my goodness me. You know, with such insights into life and just a quick snapshot. But that moment is that moment. I wouldn't expect anyone hearing me sing that to say, oh, boy, I bet he's a terrific Macbeth. you know, these are the kinds of thought processes that are behind those gear changes, in my opinion.
Well, speaking of American composers, I thought it might be nice to end today, go back to Stephen Foster, and end with your recording of one of his most beautiful songs. The flute soloist happens to be Michael Parloff.
Oh, thank you for saying. Oh, that's wonderful.
Harlan's Chamber Concerts fame, and Jay Unger is the violin soloist with Molly Mason guitar. And as it plays, I thank you so much, Thomas Hampson.
Thanks, Mitch. Great to see you.
Beautiful dreamer, wake unto me. Starlight and dewdrops are waiting for thee. Sounds of the rude world heard in the day, lulled by the moonlight, have all passed away. Beautiful dreamer, queen of my song, list while I woo thee with soft melody. Come, all the cares of life's busy throng, beautiful dreamer, awake unto me.
Baritone Thomas Hampson with music by American composer Stephen Foster. Thomas Hampson will be honored by the Metropolitan Opera Guild on Thursday, March 22nd at 7:30 at the K Playhouse at Hunter College. I'm Midge Woolsey. Thanks for listening.